This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is a bonus episode of Landslide. If you're new to the series, we recommend you go back to episode one of our story, Trust.
When it comes to the canal, we bought it, we paid for it, it's ours.
There is an issue summed up by one word that ascended in power and importance over the course of the 1970s. And while you've heard how other fights over textbooks, integration, the Equal Rights Amendment led to new battle lines between the parties, this issue became the jewel in the crown of our political divide. The issue is abortion.
I can find no evidence whatever that a fetus is not a living human being with human rights.
No topic takes up more oxygen than abortion, or has less middle ground between the parties. That was not always the case, and the way it became the case is essential listening. This is a bonus episode of Landslide about how today's abortion debate arose, or was created during the course of our story, how the fight for and against abortion rights came to map so neatly onto the political parties and the other fissures in American politics. I'm joined by UC Davis law professor Mary Ziegler, the foremost historian of the U.S. abortion debate. She starts by looking at what people used to believe, what the argument over abortion looked like before today's battle lines formed. And from there, we'll figure out how it evolved.
You'll occasionally hear people argue that Roe v. Wade created the pro-life movement, and that isn't true. Abortion already was a political issue, and it became one in part because states were starting to reform criminal abortion laws from the 19th century. But it was primarily kind of a state-by-state issue, and there was no coherent national partisan alignment. There were prominent Democrats opposed to legal abortion and prominent Democrats in favor, and the same went for Republicans. So I think it's fair to say abortion wasn't a partisan issue.
Yeah, and the national political parties, to a large extent, had tried to avoid delving into the abortion debate. Whether you were George McGovern, Richard Nixon, or most other national figures across the political spectrum, your stance on abortion was largely the same, which was that it should not be a national political issue.
Yeah, I think that's right. Even having a coherent view on abortion as a political issue at all really didn't happen much until the later 1960s. So early enough, it was essentially hard for anyone to see this as a controversial issue. There was a widely held kind of belief that opponents of abortion reform were coming to their views from a place of religion that really had no place in politics. And this was, you know, predominantly Catholic movement. I mean, there's evidence that Nixon for a time and other people had proposed the idea that it would be cool, or not cool, but productive, maybe cool too,
yeah,
to use abortion as a wedge issue. But Nixon had been reluctant to do so because he thought, correctly, you know, that his party was divided about abortion. And so even if he could have scored political points in doing that, it might have hurt a lot of other congressional Republicans.
You'd mentioned the role of Catholics. Would it be fair to say that going back to before Roe versus Wade, one of the big dividers is sort of Catholics versus non-Catholics?
The most accurate thing would be to say that almost everyone in the early anti-abortion movement was Catholic, but most Catholics were not aligned with the anti-abortion movement.
Yeah.
So very early on, polling found that views on abortion among Catholics were not a lot more conservative than they were among other groups. So this was an instance where you had a movement that was very much Catholic-led, but it wasn't clear the extent to which that movement represented most American Catholics, even at the beginning.
Yeah, that's interesting. And one other thing that struck me from your first book, After Roe, was that the arguments in favor and opposing abortion rights were just very different from what we hear today. So not just the battle lines themselves, but actually the reasons for those lines. And I'm wondering if you can take the position of someone vocally on each side of the time and kind of channel what those main points might be that we would have heard.
Yeah, so there's some commonalities, right? So one of the most common was on the anti-abortion side, the idea that liberal abortion laws were unconstitutional because the word person in the 14th Amendment applied from the moment an egg was fertilized. So this is not probably just beginning to become familiar because of conflicts about fetal personhood coming out of Alabama with a decision on IVF. So those arguments were still in play. On the abortion rights side, the arguments changed over time, right? So at the beginning, you had pretty modest calls for reform. Those tended to focus on the kind of public health risks of illegal abortion, right? The idea that some people, not all people, were having negative health outcomes because of botched illegal abortions.
And there was a doctor movement as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Because physicians had kind of gotten used to the idea that they would call shots about when an abortion was needed. And over time, they lost some of that discretion. And so they argued that they had rights to practice medicine as they saw fit. Over time, the movement shifted from calls for reform to calls for repeal. And the repeal movement, again, had some sort of familiar and unfamiliar players. It certainly had feminists who framed abortion as a woman's civil right. But it also included people aligned with what was then a very popular and very complicated population control movement that included, you know, former eugenicists,
yeah,
included cold warriors who were worried about population growth somehow helping the Soviet Union. So it was a much bigger tent. And some of the people who were arguing for legalizing abortion weren't even doing it based on rights at all. They were saying it would have desirable policy outcomes, right? That could be welfare expenses would be lowered or fewer people would be born outside of marriage. Like lots of arguments that may be troubling to a contemporary audience, as well as arguments that would be familiar. And the same goes for the anti-abortion movement. So the anti-abortion movement would also say things like, this is really about married women wanting the benefits of marriage, meaning sex, but not the burdens, meaning pregnancy.
Well, and I appreciate you setting that up, because essentially the landscape is just really alien to, I think, what we're familiar with today. And there is a story that I think most listeners, and I know certainly I was familiar with, that story is that the Roe versus Wade decision comes down. And it creates a lightning bolt in American politics, you know, immediate polarization, mobilizes evangelical voters, and ultimately shapes the Christian right. And we know that's not true. You know, in our series, we just explored how that is not true.
When the Internal Revenue Service began coming after the tax exemption of evangelical schools, meaning segregation academies, he said that's what got the movement started.
The Internal Revenue Service has begun hearings in Washington on its proposal to take away the tax-exempt status of hundreds of private schools.
These men do not have the rightful authority to tell us how to run our schools, our homes, and our churches.
We need to work together at the grassroots level and take control.
What was the initial reaction to Roe versus Wade? What effect did it have politically?
But it didn't have the effect it had immediately, in part because, and I think this is an important thing to emphasize, what Roe v. Wade meant changed over time. Neither party made that big a deal of Roe v. Wade. Both major political party candidates in the next election, Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, took kind of muddy middle ground positions on abortion. The next justice to be nominated to the Supreme Court in the aftermath of Roe faced no questions about abortion or Roe in his confirmation hearings. Evangelical Protestants, the Southern Baptist Convention, didn't change its position on abortion, which was, again, sort of a middle ground position opposed to what the Southern Baptist Convention called abortion on demand, but also opposed to, you know, abortion bans with no exceptions. That didn't change until the end of the decade. So when you look at sort of how did abortion become a defining American political issue, you can't simply look at Roe. That's borne out even more today, of course, because the Supreme Court, in overruling Roe, explained that the reason the U.S. abortion debate had become so dysfunctional was because the Supreme Court had taken the issue away from the American people. And if the issue was restored to the American people, it would be less divisive. That turned out to be wrong, too, unsurprisingly, because Roe hadn't caused the polarization in the first place, right? There were lots of other causes.
Abortion did not create our partisan battle lines. The debate was messy and fragmented, driven in some cases by entirely different constituencies and arguments. In other words, it was not predestined to transform into a central focus of our politics, or that it would break along today's lines. When we come back in just a moment, we'll look at how that happened and how it involved familiar players that you heard throughout our series.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1972, the year before Roe, a woman stood up at the Democratic National Convention. And for the first time, she argued for the party to embrace abortion rights in its platform.
I say that we should begin to put an end to this cruel, capricious, and unconstitutional interference in a fundamental human right. Thank you.
The proposal was rejected.
All those opposed, no.
But this moment speaks to a shift in the debate. You can hear how women's rights was becoming the core argument for abortion rights. And as the women's movement claimed abortion as an issue, opponents of that movement looked to capitalize.
Yeah, so in the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of leading abortion rights groups had feminist members, but they steered clear of feminist arguments, thinking that they would be less palatable to the people in power, right? People in Congress, justices on the Supreme Court. And this was at a time when there was literally not a women's restroom at the U.S. Supreme Court. Like, if you were doing an oral argument and you were a woman, you had to figure out, you know, a backup plan. So that began to change as the 1970s continued. Other arguments that had been common, like population control arguments, began to kind of trigger a backlash. At the same time, there were more women, and particularly feminists, who gained positions of leadership and who were able more effectively to change the way the organizations described what a legal abortion meant.
One of the things that we hear kind of throughout our series is this other movement in the country.
The new right conservatism.
A grassroots political machine being developed, which kind of gains the name the new right. Different activists and organizations finding single issues, specifically social issues, cultural issues, finding people who are conservative and wary of the changing culture. And they're putting them together and knitting them into a coalition. And some of these activists and organizers see abortion as a particularly juicy issue. They found a way that it speaks to other people who were already in this coalition, people who opposed new textbooks and integrating schools by busing students. Were those connections between those other issues and abortion natural? Were they created, or was it both?
It was both. So there were some Catholics who were very conservative on questions about sex and reproduction who didn't really feel comfortable with the new right on any other issue. And there were others who were very conservative on every issue of the day, from, you know, the Vietnam War to the Equal Rights Amendment to abortion. So the leaders of the new right saw this possibility, and in doing so, sort of picked winners and losers in this anti-abortion coalition. So lots of this sort of first generation of activists, some of them dropped out, right? Some of them said, this isn't a movement I can be part of anymore.
Yeah, you describe anti-Vietnam War liberals who oppose abortion on the same grounds that they opposed the Vietnam War. And they don't fit comfortably into this sort of, you know, vibrant anti-communism and social conservatism of the new right.
Yeah, and I think the new right was able to say to many members of the movement, aligning with us is the path to relevance. It's the path to stability. It's the path to funding. It's a path to being seen as something other than a sectarian cause. Again, remembering that before this, it had been predominantly Catholic. And all of that was, of course, incredibly powerful and tempting to what had been kind of a marginal movement.
There are some stories that you tell, and I'm just wondering if you can give us the bullet points of the journey of Marjorie Mecklenburg.
Right. So Marjorie Mecklenburg was one of the most effective pre-Roe activists. She and her husband were sort of like the power couple of the pre-Roe anti-abortion movement. But she had always been, one, a supporter of broader contraceptive access, two, very concerned that discrimination against women who had children outside of marriage was driving abortion. So, for example, she was campaigning for expanding protections against employment discrimination for pregnant workers. And so, you know, she wasn't a marginal figure before or even after Roe at all. She was a pretty prominent member holding positions of power. And over time, she found herself having to face a sort of Hobson's choice between changing what she cared about and focused on and losing influence. So she became, ironically, a prominent figure in Ronald Reagan's presidential administration tasked with family planning policy. And she, you know, someone again who had argued that contraceptive access would reduce abortions, became the face of sort of abstinence-only sex education policies and a critic of contraception. So Mecklenburg sort of embodies one path that was available to anti-abortion activists at this time, which was essentially, if they had been uncomfortable with the political right, they had to become comfortable and change their substantive views, or at least public positions, to remain politically relevant.
Ultimately, today, evangelicals are, I think, who we associate as the biggest opponents to abortion. And we know from our series that the Christian right did not form an opposition to abortion, as we heard. I take it at face value that today, evangelical Christians who oppose abortion on the grounds that they think the fetus has personhood, that they believe that. What I'm interested in is how that change occurs. And of course, we can do this on the other side as well. But essentially, if you were to trace over the course of the 1970s how someone who either may not have had this issue on their radar or more likely just did not have a hardened, firm stance on it comes to say, this is now a defining issue to me, how would you sketch that happening?
The more abortion became associated with women's rights, the more it became a kind of target for conservative Christians who were anxious, of course, not just about the women's movement. They were also anxious about an emerging movement for LGBTQ rights. They were anxious about the advent of no-fault divorce. But I think what was really seductive and why Roe and abortion became a particular focal point was that conservative Christians could promise their followers that there was something you could do about abortion. Like, there was no way to kind of magically disappear the birth control pill or make gay rights activists disappear. But you could, in theory, undo Roe v. Wade. So this was, at least in theory, a battle in the wars over sex and gender that conservative Christians could win, right? So you began to see, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention changing its position. You began to see large numbers of conservative evangelical Protestants joining what had previously been overwhelmingly Catholic organizations. And you began to see leaders in the movement deploying different ideas of fetal life. For example, Francis Schaeffer, who was a famous kind of a pop theologian, produced a widely circulated movie purported to be sort of a popular history of Western civilization, but also denounced abortion.
There is a strange silence on the part of the law in reference to the fact that infanticide is being practiced today quite openly by members of the medical profession.
The idea being abortion as a sort of violation of Christian teachings. And at the same time, you began to see the Republican Party trying to align with these movements and present what they were about as consistent with political conservatism as much as religious conservatism.
When you look at today's political divide, and you think about abortion as an issue and the way that it has developed, do you see alternate paths that this could have gone down in a way that it does not become today's polarizing issue?
In a way, yes, right? I mean, I think one of the features you see in American abortion politics is that so much is driven by partisanship. If you look at actual public opinion on abortion, it's nuanced, but it's also incredibly stable over time and tends to diverge pretty strongly from what policy on abortion has looked like. That suggests there's obviously a possible alternative that reflects what most people actually have wanted and still want. I think also it's clear that at various points in history, there were more Americans who thought that it was possible to care about fetal life and about women's rights. There are some polls suggesting that some third of Americans think life begins at conception and abortion shouldn't be criminal. And the question is, like, well, what are they talking about? What they're talking about, again, I think, is that you don't need to think, if you think fetal life has value, that you need to criminalize things. That was sort of a product of a particular political evolution that wasn't inevitable.
It wasn't inevitable. Mary Ziegler is a law professor at UC Davis and author of multiple books about the history of abortion. Mary, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back next week with another bonus episode. And if you'd like another full season of Landslide, you can help make it happen by sharing the series with your friends, rating it, and signing up for our mailing list at nuancetales.com. This episode is created, produced, and mixed by me, and all music is by Matt Bradford. Landslide is a production of Nuance Tales in partnership with WFAE, distributed by the NPR Network.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.